Once again, you're listening to Dade City Community Radio from the Grassy Knoll. I think we're going to pick up pretty much where we left off, but I guess we're heading toward the Visigoth here is going to drag us down the path of the Masonic order.
Freemasonry.
Right. Not a bad thing, by the way. Many millions of people in the United States are members of the Masonic organization.
And I would say that perhaps 90% of them or more have no clue about what's going on in the high degrees.
The Shriners run the hospital and burn centers.
They do.
Do a lot of good things for a lot of people.
That's true. But they are not of the initiates, and therefore they do not know.
They don't have a clue what's happening at the top.
Right. We're looking right now at a photo of the Washington Monument. Have you ever have you ever been up in there?
Oh, yeah. I've stood right next to it, looked straight up. In fact, there might be some Masonic people right there, as a matter of fact.
We also have a
television here. We're looking at news.
Oh,
he's being indicted for child molestation. I think that's a different case.
Why should he be any different?
Yeah, okay. But, yes, I have seen the Washington Monument.
Well, what have we been doing with this thing all these years? I mean, what is this thing?
Well, it's a symbol.
Yeah. Of what?
It's a big symbol. It's Washington's monument. It's a monument.
What are we supposed to like attach to that?
Well, I can think of some things, but it is certainly, without a doubt, the world's tallest masonry structure. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Maybe it is a tribute to the Masons. Freemasonry in our country.
Well,
and
you're right.
Not necessarily.
Although the monument was authorized by Congress in 1833, they didn't really complete it until 1848. The delay of over 50 years was because of the Civil War and then congressional debates and public protest about the thing. Now, why would they put a public protest what Congress is authorized to be built? Well, it turns out that the Smithsonian magazine stated that the undertaking, which was the completion of the monument, was eventually financed by a private society rather than the federal government. Now, let's take you from 1884 to July 14, 1998, the 150th anniversary reenactment of the laying of the cornerstone of the Washington Monument, and who was in attendance? The Grand Lodge of Masons of the District of Columbia and the National Park Service commemorated the anniversary with the laying of the Washington Monument's cornerstone in a public reenactment of the original 1848 ceremony. In attendance, Eldon J. Brown, Grand Master of Masons of the District of Columbia, and assisted by the Grand Lodge of Masons of the District of Columbia. I guess what they're trying to say is that the Masons of the District of Columbia were there. Who else was there? Nobody of really any import. You won't find that amongst your papers. I snuck that one in there.
I was gonna say, one of the things we want to remind people is that we're not making this stuff up. This is all documented, and there are places that if you email the Visigoth at pascoradio.org, click on the contact site, you'd be more than happy to route these people to go find this stuff. Is that correct?
Well, this release I'm reading from was from the National Park Service website. The little bit of a history they have says the cornerstone of the Washington Monument was laid on July 4, 1848 by Benjamin B. French, Grand Master of the Masons of the District of Columbia, also present, like by the way, were President James K. Polk and the former First Lady Dolly Madison and the Washington National Monument Society. And it talks about how Masonic groups have raised more than $38,000 to restore the monument. I mean, this is a symbol of Freemasonry. And Freemasonry is from the pit of hell. And interestingly, there are 13, not Washington monuments, but obelisks.
Yes.
In St. Petersburg Basilica in Rome. Now, is that any coincidence?
Nor is the number 13.
Ah, interesting.
Once we go again.
Yeah,
you know.
There we go. Numerology. All right, and it says the very same obelisk that once stood at the ancient temple in Egypt, which was the center of Egyptian paganism, now stands before the Mother Church of Romanism. This seems like more than a mere coincidence. So that one that they've got out there, the one that's most often photographed, is straight from Egypt.
You know, the thing I'd forgot about, we were touching on the number 13 real quick, is the somewhere somebody sent me something a long time ago about the argument that 13 was not an unlucky number, and it had all the things that 13 had to do with the United States. And, I believe if the alternate stripes on the flag, correct me if I'm wrong, they're 13, 13 original colonies, 13, the number keeps reinventing itself all through the history of the Republic, and it might not be 13th Amendment of the Constitution, go dig up with that one.
That wasn't a good one now, I can't remember, but that was one that they played a game with by not letting the southern states come in.
13 was a very big number in the history of the United States.
There's some symbolism behind the obelisk. And we're going to go to the book Babylon Mystery Religion by Ralph Woodrow. And he talks about the obelisk as such. It was associated with sun worship. The ancients, having rejected the knowledge of the true creator, seeing that the sun gave life to plants and to man, looked upon the sun as a god, the great life giver. To them, upright objects, such as the obelisk, also had a sexual significance. Huh, really? Mm. Realizing that through sexual union, life was produced. That's a stretch. The phallus was considered, along with the sun, a symbol of life. These were beliefs represented by the obelisks.
I wonder if the Tower of Babel would have been considered an obelisk. Remember the Old Testament where they built the...
Very interesting, yeah. And
what did God do? He struck down all these people, and that's the origin of the different languages, but confused them, hence the word Babel.
Right.
But I wonder
if it might have very well
Luciferian
been.
And its roots, and God punished the people.
It was anti-God. Yep. You guys have nothing better to do than build a tower to me? No, I don't think so. And I'm going to make a prediction here. When they rebuild whatever they rebuild in place of the WTC, I bet you they will be much like the structure, I would say, of an obelisk. But when you go down to D.C., if you ever take I-95 just to the east of the city, you will see on the Virginia side the headquarters for Freemasonry. And that building is an obelisk. It has the slanted four-sided roof. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm saying a WTC will look like that.
That would be interesting.
All right. Books of Freemasonry, Theosophy, and Other Mystery Religions state that it is not intended that the uninitiated or lower orders understand occult symbols, but it is important that they ignorantly venerate and even worship them. It is further believed by esotericists that the obelisks and other monoliths hold the sacred mysteries which were known to the ancient religions. Throughout the ages, these mysteries or secret doctrines have been entrusted only to the adepts, the sages, or the elect. Nevertheless, they will be revealed to the world at the end of the age. James Webb describes the 19th century occult revival as a wild return to archaic forms of belief, and among the intelligentsia, a sinister concentration on superstitions which had been thought buried. Now remember, he's saying this in the 19th century, we're talking about the 1800s. They're saying that there was a real breach of faith amongst Christians because their world was rocked in 1859, by the publishing of Charles Darwin's The Origins of Species.
Right.
And, of course, that's a bone of contention to this day between creationists and evolutionists.
I'm a little more sympathetic with Darwin than a lot of people are, because I don't think that, and I think even by his own pen, that what he was writing and what he intended to pass were entirely two different things. And wasn't he also a man of the cloth?
I do not believe that. I don't know, but I do not believe that.
But he wasn't anti-God or anti, at least from his own admission. And that's debatable, I'm sure, by some people. But Darwin, I seem to think, had approached things from a scientific perspective that days, the sixth day of creation might not necessarily be a 24, might be 6 million years of, and that was the point he was trying, that things do change. And
well, there's something interesting, and I'm just doing this, from a cursory understanding of what's going on. But the scientist Galton, who was the person who basically founded eugenics, was a cousin of Darwin, and he definitely ran with the idea of eugenics based on some premises in Darwin. I'm not blaming Darwin for what Galton did, but, I don't... I don't know that Darwin wasn't a bit on the elitist side myself, but you know, to that I cannot get much deeper. Moving on to the Masonic symbolism, and we have something of interest that we found in the Imaki's encyclopedia.
This is a great.
It's a great book. It's a great.
If you have a public library nearby, I would hopefully go and investigate, see if you can find this. But on page 253, there's a Masonic portrait called "Onward to the Heights," and it's the vision of the craft for labor, unity, and brotherhood. Isn't that beautiful?
It sounds so wonderful.
And you see these people.
In the foreground.
In the foreground, holding hands. The guy's got the trowel out. They're building something here.
Notice a pyramid at the bottom.
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Little pyramid down there. Just stuck that baby in there. And then?
In the background, very faint.
Very muslin.
Very much. Is a truncated pyramid.
And what would be on top of that truncated pyramid?
It looks like an all-seeing eye. And I have seen this before. Before I ever saw this painting or drawing on the Great Seal of the United States, which can be found on old $1 bills.
Federal Reserve notes. Federal Reserve notes when they used to be silver notes.
Yes.
On the back, the left-hand side, we have the truncated pyramid with the all-seeing eye.
Which looks strangely similar to the one on page 253 of the Masonic Encyclopedia.
And the words above it, or the Latin, annuit septis.
What does that mean?
It means providence has favored our undertakings.
That sounds pretty, come on,
I'll tell you what, this nice comes from the website greatseal.com, and I have to admit that this individual who wrote this is trying to say it has none of those connotations. Well, that's fine. You know, that's what you say. Here's his take. In the zenith of an unfinished pyramid on the reverse side of the Great Seal is an eye in a triangle surrounded with a glory. Over the eye, these words, annuit septis. This Latin phrase has been traced to Virgil, the renowned Roman poet who had lived in the first century B.C. All right, fine. Let's see.
What does it say underneath it, though?
All right, there you go. Okay, so fine, we can live with that. Okay, now, underneath it, we have Novus Ordo Seclorum, which literally translated comes out to a new order of the ages.
Right.
But by any other name.
New world order.
All right, give me a break. You know, one without the other? Okay. The two together? Come on. All right. But you know, we're not done.
Come on.
Flip that dollar over to just to the right of Georgie. All right. Inside, what is written there? We're too old to see this stuff.
The Department of the Treasury.
That doesn't do anything for us. All right. Well, we have inside the shield, we have the balance.
The scale.
Fairness, right?
Right.
Below, we have the key, which I assume means wisdom.
The key to the treasury. Anyway, go ahead.
Key to the kingdom. Right. No, that's all right. That's all right. But what do you have in between that could possibly be construed as a tool that a mason might use?
It looks like that old square.
There you go. Thank you very much. It isn't just, a stripe. That is a builder's square.
It means balance books.
And I want that dollar back.
Oh, okay. I'm still looking.
Oh, you're working on it. All right. So there you have all this Freemasonry symbolism on the dollar. For some reason, we just never even...
Well, you missed the most important Freemasonry symbol on it.
There's another one. Just remind me. Go ahead. What?
The president.
Georgie.
George Washington, who was a Freemason and had as many as 20 to 30... officers under his command in the Revolutionary War who were also Freemasons. Interesting.
Yes.
But, a lot of people, there might be another symbol that you might want to talk about.
Well, there is, and this one.
But, the guy's face.
Well, as prominent as George is, this is how minuscule this one is. Take a look in the upper right-hand corner of the number one. You see how it has sculpted corners?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see at the bottom of that sculpted corner?
That points toward the base of the one.
What are you looking at?
I'm looking at this thing right there.
Oh, no, up top.
Okay.
Up top. If you look at the left sculpted corner, you'll see a little white thing right in the palm of that. There's a little cross-hatching, but look, there's a white little white dot.
Okay, I see it.
It's right. That, when it's blown up, is an owl, which is also a Freemason symbol.
Going back to Alex Jones and his friends at Bohemian Grove.
Moloch. There you go. I never put that together. Most excellent, Dr. Swain.
Observation right there.
All right, link that dollar bill. Come over here a little bit more. Thank you very much.
Which, by the way, several of the people who that he had photographed at Bohemian Grove, it's not a plug for Alex Jones, were also Masons.
Yeah.
And I had no idea, and we're on a tangent here, but I did a little research at the house myself, and I'm not going to let this go, but greater than 50%, and I don't recall the exact number, but better than half of all presidents that have served in office in this country have been Masons.
I think you can keep on going, right?
And I'll tell you, there's even, and I'm going to tell you something too, there are some of these guys may not have been Master Masons. They were at the initiate level. But one of those people dispels all rumors about the Roman Catholic Church, because at the initiate level of the Masons was John F. Kennedy. So that crap about Catholics not being as bogus, bunk. Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon, Mason, Lyndon Johnson, you know.
Truman.
Truman was a Master Mason, but they had all the varying degrees, but these guys were all plugged in. And of course, the first presidents, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, George Washington, it doesn't stop.
Well, also on the website watch.pair.com, actually from which I am reading a lot of this information from Woodward's book, does state today how many people in office, like Trent Lott is a 33rd degree.
Oh, yeah, the members of Congress.
Jack Kemp, yeah, sure. How much time do you think we have?
We got 15 minutes.
Okay. I'm going to get to some famous personages in Freemasonry through history. But before that, we'll just go to some of this Masonic symbolism. Masonry is, according to its own philosophers, a system of pure religion expressed in symbols, one which cannot be understood without a knowledge of the true meaning of them. This makes a proper understanding of those symbols terribly important. For the Christian Mason, accepting and guarding those symbols and their secrets with his physical life at stake, he must understand them to know what he has done right. Herein lies the most terrible manifestation of Masonic morality, that philosophy of the elite which makes whatever they do right because it is they, the elite, who do it. Also reminds me of the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
Having established and taught the sincere but deceived masses of Masons, that would be the Blue Lodge Masons, of which there's only 3 degrees, that everything depends upon their proper understanding of the symbols of Masonry, they have then deliberately deceived them as to the true meaning of those symbols. Hear the arrogant words of Albert Pike, here he goes again, Supreme Pontiff of Universal Freemasonry. Pike says, the blue degrees are but the court or portico of the temple. Part of the symbols are displayed there to the initiate, but he is intentionally misled by false interpretations. It is not intended that he shall understand them, but it is intended that he shall imagine that he understands them. Their true explication is reserved only for the adepts, the princes of Masonry. Woodrow goes on to say, since the true meaning of Masonic symbols is to be known only by the prince adepts of Masonry, we must hear what they say concerning them. They, meaning Pike and Mackey, J.D. Buck, Daniel Sickles, and others, teach that Masonry is a revival of the ancient mysteries, the mystery religions of Babylon, Egypt, Persia, Rome, and Greece.
I'm starting to feel bad.
About what?
I'm digging through, while you're talking here, I'm digging through this.
No, that's okay. That's all right.
I wanted John Paul Jones, naval commander. Member of the Masonic Lodge.
Also in Led Zeppelin?
No, different.
Okay.
Congress authorized something, a Masonic symbol. There's some shrine for this guy in Washington, D.C. as a naval officer during the Revolutionary War. And Congress appropriated and paid for a Masonic symbol to be placed at his gravesite. How many gravesites here were seen where you go to and you see the Masonic symbols
sure.
on the stones?
Sure. In fact, we're going to get into something here about the Masonic initiation. And this goes about the false trinity, the whole nine yards, and also with symbolic Masonry symbolism at gravesites.
Okay. And I'm going to take the opposite here because I have right in front of me the initiation form.
Okay.
So.
Oh, this is going to... All right, it won't be word
yeah,
for
we'll
word.
Yeah, well, go ahead. You know.
All right, the heart of Freemasonry is the Blue Lodge with its 3 degrees. The climactic degree, and the final one for most Masons, is the third, or Master Mason degree.
Right.
The heart of the Master Mason degree, the thing that gives it both meaning and substance, is without any doubt the reenactment of the legend of Hiram Abiff. It is the central figure in the legend, this Hiram, the widow's son, the Tyranian architect, this first Grand Master, who is impersonated by every man who is initiated as a Master Mason. It is Hiram who is at the very heart of the foundation of all Masonry. Now, this is an interesting story that ties into King Solomon. Abiff was the first Grand Master Mason. While putting up the temple, I don't know if I want to paraphrase this or not, but what happened was, knowing the secrets of a Master Mason would enable the Masons working on the temple, the others, to become Master Masons and also earn higher wages. So that's a pretty everyday thing.
Sure.
Okay? Hiram promised to reveal the secrets of a Master Mason upon the completion of the temple. Well, apparently that wasn't good for some of the underlings. They three ruffians, they call it, threatened and finally murdered Hiram Abiff. Now, here's where we get into this motif of a death, a resurrection, and an afterlife, which you would have also found in E.T.
Sure.
All right. King Solomon sent a search team out for the body of Hiram, but was unable to raise him from the dead. Solomon himself raised and restored Hiram to life with the grip of a Master Mason. In other words, the posse couldn't bring him to life, but Solomon did. The first word which Hiram spoke was the replacement for the Grand Masonic word. This is like the secret word, which is traditionally given to a Master Mason during his initiation. So in other words, he supplanted it with another one. As for the legend of Hiram Abiff, Shaw, who we quoted before, explains, Osiris, both king of the Egyptians and their god, went on a long journey to bless neighboring nations with his knowledge of arts and sciences. His jealous brother, Typhon, god of winter, conspired to murder him, steal his kingdom, and did so. Isis, sister and wife of Osiris and his queen, as well as Egypt's moon goddess, set out on a search for the body, making inquiries of all she met. After certain adventures, she found the body with an acacia tree at the head of a coffin. Returning home, she secretly buried the body, intending to give it proper burial as soon as arrangements could be made. Typhon, by treachery, stole the body, cut it up into 14 pieces, and hid them in many places. Isis then made a second search and located all the pieces but one, which gives you 13. The one missing and lost part was the phallus, hence obelisk. Uh-huh. She made a substitute phallus, consecrated, and became a sacred substitute and the object of worship. Since Masonic manuals also state that Hiram is a type of Osiris, the esoteric meaning of these ruffians, the three ruffians, if you remember, is rather the triune god who destroyed the religious system of Egypt, which system has been revived through the secret societies. I'm just looking to see. All right, Shaw continues. Thus, it seems clear that Hiram Abiff of Freemasonry is not a historical character and certainly not a biblical one. Rather, he actually represents Osiris, the Egyptian sun god, and the reenactment of the legend of Hiram Abiff is actually the reenactment of the legend of Isis and Osiris. Thus, each sincere man who is initiated into the third Master Mason degree of Masonry impersonates Osiris, the sun god of Egypt, and enters into his life of good deeds, his death, his burial, and his raised and his resurrection from the dead. And that is a complete counterfeit of the resurrection story as it regards Jesus Christ. So it is definitely a counterfeit religion.
Well, it says right here, I'm looking at the investigation form for the Grand Lodge, Tyran Lodge of Cleveland, Ohio.
Not to pick on Cleveland.
And it says right here, number one, do you attend church? What church do you or did your parents attend? What church does your wife attend? And then down here it says, do you believe in the ever-living God as revealed in the Holy Scriptures? I mean,
what's going on?
What's going on? I'm also noticing a Masonic symbol that
looking very much like
the Star of David,
right? And of course, that is also the Satanic pentagram. So, I mean, the five-sided object. And listen, what do we got down in Virginia that just recently had supposedly a plane fly into it? The Pentagon.
Yeah.
Again, five-sided.
There's an awful lot. We got about 7 minutes left here.
All right, then let me, as I had promised, if you don't mind, the story about Booth that
okay,
we did not get into.
I'm dying to know the connection there.
All right, this comes from Eric John Phelps' tome, the Vatican assassins. And he says, according to the escape and suicide of John Wilkes Booth by Finis Bates, Booth escaped Washington with a password, a Masonic password, the word perhaps. He settled in Kansas and died there, having confessed to Lincoln's murder in the presence of his presiding doctor. But if Booth's body was identified, having been shot by Boston Corbett, while the real Booth escaped, who then identified the body? Well, it was a 33rd degree Freemason, Admiral G.W. Baird, USN retired, who in 1921 wrote, "I was called on board the Montauk, which was a Navy gunboat, by Lieutenant W.W. Crowninshield to identify the body of John Wilkes Booth, which I did. Surgeon General Barnes arrived at that moment and probed the wound in Booth's neck." It is also incriminating to note that R.W. Thompson, who was a 33rd degree Freemason and contemporary of his Masonic brother, Admiral Baird, wrote The Footprints of the Jesuits, extensively quoted in this volume. Thompson was the ex-Secretary of the Navy in 1894 when he published that book. Baird, as an admiral, had been Thompson's subordinate prior to 1894. Nowhere in Thompson's 500-page volume does he implicate the Jesuits in Lincoln's assassination. He doesn't even mention Lincoln's assassination, even though that murder was fresh on the minds of millions of Americans. So, and Booth, I believe, yes, was a Freemason as well.
Yeah.
And he was aided and abetted by a very strange character in history by the name of John Surratt. Does that ring a bell with you at all?
No.
I don't think any of us know this.
There's a lot of Surratts that live around Dade City.
Surratts?
Yeah.
Might that be, yeah, all right. They hang around garbage cans, do they?
I don't know.
We know that what? I think 12 people did get hanged for the conspiracy. But it says the key player in the assassination was a young Roman Catholic and former Secret Service agent for the Confederacy, having called time outside of Ford's Theater, which means he would tell people how many minutes there was left to come back inside if they had a break. He was outside of Ford's Theater during the president's murder. John Surratt escaped from the United States into Montreal with the aid of the priests, meaning Jesuits, from Montreal to Londonderry, to Liverpool, to Rome. Get this, he enlists in the Pope's Zouave army. Having been recognized by a boyfriend, friend, what's the chances you're going to be recognized over the Vatican? You know? Surratt confessed to the murder, stating, "I have done." Having been arrested, Surratt leapt down a precipice, made his way to Naples, boarded a steamer, and escaped to Alexandria, Egypt. But there in 1867, he was arrested by U.S. authorities and returned to Washington to stand trial for the murder of President Lincoln. But on his arrival as a prisoner in the United States, his Jesuit father confessor whispered in his ear, "Fear not, you will not be condemned. Through the influence of a high Roman Catholic lady, two or three of the jurymen will be Roman Catholics, and you will be safe." Surratt did not overestimate the protection of his church. From the moment he had landed in the country, he was greeted and sustained by the priests of the church. When his trial began in Washington on June 10, 1867, the presence of Roman priests and the students from the Jesuit University at Georgetown, who begat us, Bill Clinton, and the Sulpician Monastery, where he had studied there for years for the priesthood, were the most noticeable features of the sessions. Although he declared himself a bankrupt, he was furnished the services of the best lawyers. When it became necessary to furnish bail for his release, it was immediately presented by an Irish woman he did not even know, to the amount of $30,000. According to press reports, this stood there until his death in 1916. And he ends with, and this is Phelps saying, "This is some friendship, is it not?"
I like it.
So that's the story about John Surratt, who did not swing for the murder of
the president.
The president. And also other Freemasons of note. We mentioned Pike. Also James Buchanan, who was the president between 1857 and 1861, and who really did not want to go to war, or supposedly he didn't want to go to war. It said that he didn't want to ignite the war between the states in opposition to the conspiracy of Prince Metternich's Holy Alliance. Therefore, on the 23rd of February, 1857, at the National Hotel in Washington, D.C., the president and his northern men were poisoned with arsenic sprinkled in their tea. 38 people died as the order fulfilled its bloody oath once again. But Buchanan survived, and toward the end of his presidency, he sent a steamer called the Star of the West. Star?
Star of the West.
To reinforce Fort Sumter, it carrying troops and foodstuffs. This acted ignited, rather, the Jesuits-American Civil War.
I wonder if this Buchanans are related.
I'll have to check that out.
Both of them graduated from Georgetown.
I like that. I like that. Other Freemasons, and we'll wrap it up here, are J.P. Morgan and Colonel Edward Mandel House. And I won't go into that now, but he has got a very interesting past also, because he was amongst the group with the Rockefellers and Warburg who, on Jekyll Island in 1913, thought up the Federal Reserve Act. So there you have it as far as Freemasonry goes, and that's only touching the ice tip of the iceberg with regard to its involvement in our political schema.
Well, we'll wrap it up for now. Thanks again for listening. You are listening to Dade City Community Radio. This is the Grassy Knoll, and we'll talk to you next week.